Welcome to the RM Williams Outback Podcast. I'm Terry Cowley, the host of the podcast and the Senior Associate Editor of RM Williams Outback Magazine. This podcast is sponsored by Ram Trucks Australia. Great to be with you again. It's some time since we've spoken to Outback Editor-in-Chief Mark Muller. Thought it was about time to catch up with him again. Mark is obviously always working on the magazine, but always doing interesting travels and meeting interesting people along the way too. Hi, Mark.
G'day, Terry. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And how are you?
I am also very well, thank you.
Excellent. Now, there's a lot of things we could talk about, particularly in relation to 153, which is still out now, of Outback. Perhaps if you can tell us about the trip that you did down to South Australia, which was as a part of our main feature, which was on architecture in the bush.
Yes, I mean, I went down to South Australia because that's where I'm from, and I slipped down there for Christmas to see my parents and my mother-in-law. In that, we went down to Robe, where I've spent a lot of time on and off over the years, and indeed family has a house there. And one of the houses featured in the architecture story is the Hermitage, which is an 1868 building, 1855, and then extended in 1868. That's a few kilometres outside of Robe, owned by Basil and Lisa Enright. And I'd worked there with Basil maybe 25 years ago. I'd left Montana and come back to Australia and then slipped over to the coast and got a job in the Caledonian Hotel and then met Basil, who was living and working there as well. He was on one side of the bar and I was on the other, and he had some work going of planting olive groves. And so I ended up spending a few months, sort of April, May, June, digging holes and planting trees and spending a lot of time on the veranda of this beautiful old limestone building. And when we were talking with Andrew Hull about the shape of this architecture story, you know, moving through the eras of Australian architecture and the beautiful goldfields architecture around Ballarat, and then wanting to go into the coastal space, and initially, you know, Hully was looking at you know, the piers in Adelaide and whatnot, which wasn't, you know, bush enough for my liking.
We probably should explain who Hully is. So he's the photojournalist who wrote the story about architecture in the bush in the current issue.
And keen listeners to the podcast will, of course, have tuned into that beautiful conversation you had with Hully about, you know, what he did and where he went and the story of, you know, shelter in Australia.
I hope so.
We had, you know, this link from these beautiful big stone buildings in Ballarat and then on the coast of Victoria at Lawn, Ocean House by the architect Robert Mills. I'd met Robert in the Flinders Ranges maybe a decade ago and then went to what ended up being his elopement party at this beautiful house he designed on the coast. And I wanted a segue from the architecture of Ballarat to the Australian coastal space, to this beautiful modern piece of architecture, and the Hermitage came to mind because it's gorgeous, and Basil remains to this day a very good friend. And so I ducked out to the Hermitage with, as it happens, Sebastian Lipp, another one of the characters that populates my life and our working life. Seb is the CEO of Pilatus Australia, and Pilatus has been a great advertising supporter of Outback Magazine for a long time, and We'll move on to another connection with Seb later in our conversation. We all went out to the Hermitage, which has also got some good four-wheel driving tracks on it, which is another part of what we did, and photographed in part the Hermitage, this lovely limestone building with large verandas. The veranda's only just been replaced, in fact, from the original 1868 veranda, a corrugated iron veranda on along the front of this gorgeous building, which had in fact been in no small part built by Basil's great-great-grandfather, William Savage, back in the day in Robe's early days. And it was interesting to note that the corrugated iron that Will Savage had used in 1868 was, in Basil's opinion, superior to the corrugated iron he was able to get to repair and replace the veranda in the 21st century. So one of the things about the work that we do and the fact that we've been doing it together for quite a long time now, you know, close to, well, more than 20 years in my case, and close to 20 years with you. And it's something that happens throughout the bush, is, you know, connections and networks and friendships and ideas that cross-pollinate and populate. And that comes through a lot with the stories we put in the magazine. Indeed, Andrew Hull himself, we came across because we did a story on him in the magazine 18 years ago, when he was living in his hometown of Bourke and writing interesting poetry. And we wrote a story called The Bard of Bourke, and through that realised that Andrew was, you know, good in the bush, a good writer, a wonderful artist. He's one of these people who's multi-skilled. You know, he does, you know, huge public art installation works with, you know, mosaics in Western New South Wales, and as I say, is a poet and a musician and a photographer and a writer. And has a deep interest in and understanding of many aspects of life in rural and regional and remote Australia. So Harley put the architecture story together. The fact that I was slipping down to Robe to see Mum and Dad meant that I would never go to Robe without ducking out to the Hermitage and saying hello to Basil. The Hermitage itself, being this beautiful piece of architecture, enabled us to fold that into the story. And the fact that dear Seb was in Robe as well at the same time meant that we got to take a couple of interesting four-wheel drives out and give them a bit of a run too.
Yeah, and I guess the significance of the Hermitage, apart from your personal connection, which you noted in your editor's letter of the same issue, was that buildings are so infused with memory.
That's exactly right, and that's part of what I riffed on in the editorial. You know, we are, of course, seeking shelter in buildings, but, you know, a lot of the most important things in our lives, and a lot of our lives, is spent in and around various buildings, whether they're, you know, whether they're wool sheds, or whether they're our homes, or whether they're workplaces, or whether they're places to seek shelter or seek solace, or places to return to having spent, you know, long days outdoors, and all of these layers of memory fold into the place. So I mentioned, you know, the fact that we have a family house in Robe. And I've obviously spent a lot of time there from my childhood onwards. And I mentioned also the Caledonian Hotel in Robe, where I've also spent over the years a reasonable amount of time on both sides of the bar. And these are the things that resonate in place for us. You know, you might remember your school building. You might remember, you know, the building in which you first met your partner. You know, you might remember a building in which, you know, you sat with your grandparent as they died, or some such thing. Folding forward a little bit, one of the stories we're working on is libraries for a future issue. And libraries, and I had vivid memories as I was reading, you know, the early draft of that story of the library at Panola High School, which is also the state library and the community library for the town where I grew up. And I could picture it clear as day, both from Barb Smith, the librarian, to, you know, the shelves at the back where I might have stolen a kiss as a young fellow. These are all parts of the memories that live in ourselves and in our minds and in the buildings we inhabit throughout our lives.
It's very true. And if you go back to a place and it's not as you imagine it, it can be really disconcerting. I've had that situation at both my primary school and my high school because they've been totally redeveloped. And yeah, it's like, I don't know, there's something sad about it. There's something lost. But it does all still, the old buildings all still do exist in my head, that's for sure.
And I love the way that buildings can tell stories as well. I was out on Brickhouse Station over in the Murchison a few years ago, and while it's cattle country now, it was once upon a time wool country. And Aaron Land was taking, he's the manager on Brickhouse, which is owned by Harvest Road. He was at least then the manager. He's moved up to another part of the portfolio in the Kimberley now. Anyway, on the walls of this old wool shed were graffiti from shearers and whatnot. And one of it was, you know, the date, it was, I can't remember the exact date, but it was effectively 1939, Germany has invaded France, and the war's on. And there was a cartoon against it as well. And I just thought, wow, you can imagine that. You can imagine the time that it was happening, and how even the message got to them, you know, through, you know, the radio, and then into the newspaper, and then up the road, and then out on a cart to the shearing shed, and then you can see them sitting around their newspaper and going, "Crikey, boys, there's a war on." Or or things like the chisel marks in stone on old buildings particularly. I always look at those and imagine the chisel and imagine the hammer and imagine the hands that are holding them and making them, you know, as a part of a normal day's work that is still alive today. One of the things around that, our founder, R.M. Williams, Reg Williams, was a stonemason and a builder and a man who knew how to infuse buildings with spirit. And I think particularly of the Stockman's Hall of Fame in Longreach, which was a really interesting piece of modern architecture. And listeners may well have visited the hall since it was opened in 1988 by Queen Elizabeth and other dignitaries. RM, when trying to get money together for that, camped outside on the site and built a stone cottage by hand, cutting the stone and laying the beautiful flagstones and the flooring. And a fellow called Cyril Wall was a craftsman in the bush vernacular, so big two-handed saws and hand adzes, and he adzed and built all of the beams, windows and whatnot for this cottage that RM built. And every chip and every stroke is still there and still resonates with the hands that built it. And I love the way that you can have that sense of lived continuity within buildings that adds to the stories. Or, flagstones and steps that you see over decades and years and hundreds of years in some instances, the stone steps have worn down. And how many feet must have walked upon the ground to have worn that stone such that you can see massive indentations in it now? I like all that sort of stuff.
Absolutely, and I'm sure our readers will enjoy reading that story. Just changing tack a bit, but staying with issue 153 of Outback magazine, there was an obituary of adventurer, explorer, author and accomplished bushman Dennis Bartel, who you knew.
Well, I did have the privilege of spending some time with him, and this comes back to Sebastian Lipp. So in 2021, Seb took a suite of vehicles, three vehicles across the Simpson Desert with Dennis Bartel. Now, Seb knows a chap called Brendan Eblen, and Brendan is a wonderful fellow, from Port Augusta originally, many years there, a house painter who then ended up getting work up and down the Birdsville track, painting shearers' quarters and houses and whatnot when people realised that he was useful in the bush and a fine craftsman. He ended up having a heritage restoration painting business based sort of out of Harndorf in the Adelaide Hills, where if, for example, the library and Parliament House, a 19th century building, needed repair, Brendan was the man who came in to paint it. Now, Brendan, among other things, was also on the board of the Central Division of the Royal Flying Doctors Service for 20 years, and it is in that capacity that he became friends with Dennis Bartel. Dennis, in 1985, walked from Gulf to Gulf raising money for the RFDS. That is, he walked from Burketown in Queensland to Glenelg in South Australia across the Simpson Desert. And Brendan, in fact, was there as a young man rattling a can trying to get some coins from the crowd that had gathered at Glenelg to help put money together for the RFDS. And so Dennis, born in 1933, died at the age of 90, and I met him when he was 88, because Dennis had crossed the Simpson Desert some 70 times in his life. He'd done it in vehicles. He'd walked across it several times. He'd ridden camels across it. He's done all sorts of things. And we wanted to put a plaque on the French line where Dennis had crossed it back in the mid-1980s to commemorate that, and indeed to take Dennis into the desert. Now, Sebastian knows Brendan very well because the RFDS buys Pilatus planes, the PC-12 particularly, and now the PC-24 are used by aeromedical services across Australia. They're great planes for landing and taking off on gravel. They can fly a long way, they can go fast, and they can cop rough country. And so with that RFDS connection between Brendan and Sebastian and Dennis, we had this idea to get Dennis back out into the Simpson Desert and did so. And we picked Dennis and Brendan up like a service station on the outskirts of Adelaide. You could tell he was an old man. He had a couple of walking sticks and a tall fellow, rangy and lean, but a bit hunched over. And we thought, well, geez, we're going to have to be careful trying to nurse this bloke through the desert. We weren't giving him enough credit, really, because he was, in his prime, a strapping human being, you know, just a large, strong man who could, you know, walk literally across Australia carrying everything he needed, unassisted walking. And as we got further and further out into the desert, Dennis just perked up more and more and more, and he became more and more alive. And soon he was casting off one walking stick, and before too long he'd only pick one up to do something if he remembered to, and was just completely enlivened by the space. And we talk about a connection with buildings. Now, Dennis has this amazing connection with country, with the landscape. And so it was a real privilege to spend time with Dennis in that environment and to see the strength of the environment infusing him for what ended up being his last trip across the desert that he calls the Desert of Dreams. And indeed, in May, I'll be heading back out into the Simpson Desert with Brendan and with Sebastian to put a new date on the plaque we put out in the Simpson Desert, because, of course, Dennis died. And we run a little bit of that, an obituary and some of that story in this issue. Yes, it's a joy to have, through the magazine, get to know remarkable people, and that's certainly part of the pleasure it brings to the work that, you know, that I do and that you do, and that we then get to share with readers and listeners.
Definitely, what a special trip, special memories.
Get into a new Ram today. It's America's best truck brand 5 years running, according to US News & World Report. With unrivaled Hemi V8 power, you'll understand why Ram is dominating the competition year after year. And with Australia's best range of full-size pickup trucks, Ram eats everything else for breakfast. See your Ram dealer or visit ramtrucks.com.au and get into America's best truck brand today. Ram, enough said.
Now, there's a big splash in the middle of the magazine with a photo essay, as we call them, by Nick Joyce. What do we call Nick Joyce? Tour leader, photographer? He has a couple of different hats, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. I mean, Nick is, I guess, primarily an outdoorsman. He's a bushman. He grew up in South Australia's mid-north on the family farm, you know, mixed cropping and cattle and sheep. And, you know, five generations of Joyces before him had worked that space. And Nick, you know, was also a fairly handy athlete. He ran out for the Adelaide Crows for a couple of seasons, but injuries sidelined him quite a bit. He'd, after that sporting period in his life had passed, he decided he wanted to sort of get out of himself, because he was, you know, disappointed, of course, and went up into the Top End and loved it. And then came home and told Dad, "Well, I'm ducking off up there, but I'll be home for harvest." And in that period, he'd seen things that he loved, and he started to pick up a camera and started to take photos. And he's just got a good eye. And I came across his work on Instagram and thought, "Geez, they're nice photos." And there were photos particularly of you know, the wilds of Arnhem Land. He, in fact, ended up moving up there. He told his dad that, you know, the 10 months that he was going to go between harvests ended up being 10 years. Nick is now working closely with the traditional owners in along the Coburg Peninsula, where he's, you know, set up a safari camp, a hunting camp. So he's a bow hunter, and he's a good rifleman. He's a fine photographer, you know, and all of these things sort of play into each other. And he captures these instances in his life in a really beautiful way. He's now newly married, and he and Georgia are Territorians. They're staying up there. But Nick still folds back into, you know, the country that bore him, and that's in South Australia. And the photo essay is a collection of works all over the place. And one of the photos, in fact, is the photo that we feature on the cover, which is his two young nephews. It's just a delightful photo. You know, you've got young Elijah and Sydney Joyce there on the back of a beat-up old Toyota 70 Series Ute, standing on an Esky, one of them, and piece of polypipe in the hands of the other. And there's a dog sort of sleeping lazily on the tray as well. But the boys, as far as they're concerned, they're on a river in Arnhem Land, reeling in big barra. You can tell the polypipe's a fishing rod, and the other lad on the esky is hauling a net. And just the imagination and the life and the way that that's captured, that sense of family and vivacity and country, is, I think, a special moment. And Nick's work, more often than not, is infused with that kind of insight, that sense of scale and beauty, but also imagination and joy. And so it was a process to be able to connect and track down somebody who spends a fair bit of his time humping through the back blocks of the Coburg Peninsula with a rifle in his hand and a camera in the other to bring this work to the pages. But I'm very glad we did because I like it a lot.
Yeah, we say photo essay. That does. I mean, that's not a very good description. That it doesn't really do it justice just to call it a photo essay. I mean, you're talking about incredible full-page photos of a saltwater croc sliding back into the clear waters of the Coburg Peninsula. You're talking about wet season, storm washing across the floodplains of Arnhem Land, just to name a few things. I'm just looking through now. Tidal waterways creating their own patterns across Arnhem Land. I mean, a lot of it is aerial photography, but it's not all aerial photography. Probably one of my favourites is the wild buffalo pushing across wetlands in Arnhem Land. Like there's some lovely details in there, but there's also some great action as well.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favourite photos in that same spread where one of Nick's mates is this, it's a close-up of a set of hands with, you know, black hands and thick nails and this beaten up old rifle. And the rifle's looking really greasy. And I was asking Nick about it. I said, you know, what's the go with that old rifle? You know, I can't even tell what it is. It could be a Lee Enfield from, you know, the First World War, or it might be an old Mauser or something. But anyway, he said, oh yeah, that thing, we can't even find the right cartridges for it these days, but it keeps on working, so we keep on using it. And that sense of seeing something and zooming in on it, you know, as well as these vast panoramas of, as you say, floodplains on the Northern Territory or unnamed outback river tidalways, brolgas flying across, you know, vast tracts of tableland. But then to zoom in on something that also looks interesting and gives you a real sense of place. You know, you can smell the gun oil coming off that photograph, I reckon. It's a really interesting thing. And that's sort of what we try and do is to share through words and images, of course, the remarkable places that are to be found throughout Australia and the remarkable people who spend their lives in it.
Absolutely. Now, by the time our readers receive our magazine, of course, we've spent a long time with it. We've put it to bed. We've sent it to the printers. And literally by the time it's in our readers' hands, we're well onto the next issue. You did a trip to Tamworth recently, which will be popping up in the next issue.
Yes, indeed. I slipped up to Tamworth for the Star Maker Awards, the Toyota Star Maker Awards, the Toyota Tamworth Country Music Festival. And in getting there, I was lucky enough to get into a new LC70 Toyota Land Cruiser, the LC76, so the wagon version of the 70 series Toyota, which, you know, every station in Australia has got, you know, these old Toyotas on it. But what they've done with this one for the first time is put a four-cylinder engine in it and an automatic gearbox, which, you know, is a change from the V8 that traditionally powers those things. So it was an interesting because, you know, I'll write a motoring review on that vehicle, and I was impressed by it. But also, you know, it's nice to be out on the road, and it's nice to go for a drive. And I didn't want to just sort of drive straight up to Tamworth and roll straight into Gunnaganoo Station outside of Tamworth where we were staying, and then, you know, get caught up in all of that hubbub, which is an interesting place and space, but, you know, it's nice to get some time for yourself. So I sort of went the long way around. So I'm, you know, based in Sydney, and instead of sort of driving up the coast to Newcastle and then through the Hunter, I ducked up into the Blue Mountains and up the old Putty Road, and stayed in Tooele National Park on the way up because it was a stinking hot weekend, and, you know, the Country Music Festival was great. Tamworth's great. 36 degrees in crowds isn't as great, so I wanted to get in the right headspace beforehand, and that involved lolling about like an old lizard in some rock pools an hour south of Tamworth before heading up into town. And it was excellent. It was excellent to be camping and then to be in Tamworth and the excitement of all that music and all those people and all those crowds. In fact, was able to catch up with Murray Harton, the poet who's from Moree. He was in Tamworth for the festival, and we're featuring him in the Great Australians magazine that we're also working on at the moment. So I got to take a few photos of Mars and catch up briefly. And then, you know, through the evening with the Toyota Star Maker Awards, and then to drive back after some time on Gunnaganoo via Collie Plains North Station, which is also sort of dubbed Galea State. Now, Collie Plains North is owned by Jeff and Jane Rogers, and they've been there for 15 years or so, having spent a lifetime buying properties, improving them, and then moving on. Jeff was originally a shearer from the Mallee in Victoria, and they've led remarkable lives to get to where they are now. One of their sons, Sandy Rogers, and his new wife, Alex, are setting up accommodation, off-grid, high-end little sort of cabin things on Galea Estate. Now, the build should be finished in March, but I had this day with them. It was a lot of fun, just interesting people doing interesting work. And the evening saw Colin Selwood, who's got a restaurant in Scone, come up to cook dinner for us. These huge, some people call them tomahawk steaks. Colin likes to call them boomerang steaks. So big steaks cooked on open coals so that you sear the outside and then taken off the coals and put on a grill. And then carved on the tray of a ute, and chimichurri sauce poured over them, and a good wine. And I remember sitting in this grove of trees as the moon's rising and the fire's smoking next to us, and surrounded by good company and beautiful country, eating good food, thinking, well, as far as jobs go, I like doing this sort of thing quite a bit.
Yeah, sounds like a real hardship.
Had to keep on taking notes. The work's never far away. In fact, it was interesting, part of what we're doing now, Terry, talking, with these podcasts and, engaging in taking filmmakers onto cattle stations and whatnot. Part of my curiosity about this Tamworth trip was that Toyota's people had put together a group of those that they'd invited for the trip. And, I was there with Outback Magazine, and there were a couple of other magazines, but there were also brand ambassadors who were a part of the scene there. But also Jack Archer and Jack Tossell, two country boys who both have large followings on TikTok and Instagram, and so that social media space. And I was curious to see how that all wove together. And so on Galea Estate, for example, Alex, who also has strong skills in that media space, was filming Colin and I working with the food and cutting the wood to put together reels. And they've had some of their food reels that they do, like cooking up a piece of camembert with some cherry tomatoes on an open fire sort of thing, close to a million views on TikTok.
They do a great job with it.
They do a great job. And it's all about the storytelling. And one of the things that we talk about, our primary platform is Outback Magazine. We're now talking on our podcast, I love the fact that these stories can transfer across mediums, and I'd never want to be so wedded to one medium that we wouldn't engage in others. And I was listening to an earlier podcast of ours today, the Deschon Goat Depot, which is another story in this magazine, and you spoke to Sigo about that. But it gives an opportunity to either unfurl more of a story in a different medium or to reinforce interesting aspects of the story. We spoke earlier about Hully, talking at length about his experience and his thoughts putting together the architecture story for this magazine. And I like the way that as storytellers, we've got so many different platforms available to us to share some of the experiences and places that we deliberately seek out and that readers and listeners tell us about and tell us they want to hear about or want to find out about. And that continues to inform us as journalists and as storytellers. And long may it continue. Terry?
Yes, I think there is something in hearing somebody's voice. That's obviously something you can't get from a magazine. It adds another dimension, and that ability to go with people. So you might sit down on the lounge or the bed or wherever and read a magazine, but then you might be in the car. You're obviously not going to read a magazine in the car, but you can listen to the podcast, or you might be out on the header or out somewhere on the property, and you can, you can take us with you in the form of the podcast. And it's quite an intimate way of communicating with people, I think, too. Well, I hope it works.
Works for me. I mean, I love listening to what you're doing on the podcast. And I love listening to other podcasts as well. And you're exactly right. And there are some times where you can't be sitting reading or you can't be watching a screen and you've got things to do. And to have the company of the voices in your head in such a way that you continue to either be entertained or informed or learn about things or think about things that you wouldn't otherwise do. And the on-demand nature of the podcasting too, I like, because you'll be out in the back blocks and you can't get a radio signal. You can't listen to the radio or it's too crackly, or you're tired of listening to the songs that you might have in your phone. And you're transported and you get to both do what you're doing and also think about other things. I reckon it's good fun.
I think it's good fun too. I enjoy it. Well, that probably wraps things up, Mark, unless you'd like to say something more looking to the future, looking to the next issue, thinking about any travel plans you have coming up or any big things you want to let our listeners know about.
Well, yeah, we've riffed a little bit on that trip into the Simpson Desert in May. I'm very much looking forward to that. Prior to that, I'll be heading up to Rockhampton for Beef Week, which is always a great show. One of the things I love about Beef Week, of course, is that you get hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who are committed to the bush and to the industry, all gathering to share knowledge and have a good time. So I'm looking forward to getting up to Rockhampton. I'm hoping, although I may not be able to do it, to slip up to Kempsey in a couple of weeks' time to the Akubra workshop, you know, where some of the finest hats in the world are made by hand to this very day. You, well, I was recently on a little bit of leave and you commissioned yourself to head back to one of your favourite parts of the world, which is where I'm actually from, the southeast of South Australia, to explore Kilsby Sinkhole. And you were talking with Outback contributor Andrew Bain about that in your previous podcast, as I recall. So you're going to go, are you going to get in the water or are you just going to drink the water? They're making gin out of it now, aren't they?
Definitely both.
Bit of both. Fair enough. As long as you get the order right, everything will be fine.
True, definitely swimming before drinking, always. And you did mention Rockhampton. We'll just quickly slip in a mention for the Great Western Hotel at Rockhampton. Maybe you will drop in there. That, of course, also features in our issue 153 of Outback.
That is true. I might find myself at the Great Western. You never know.
You have occasionally been known to go into a pub.
I have. I think there are, whether you're in there for a cup of tea or a glass of lemonade or a cold beer or whatever, they're wonderful community hubs. And there's an absolute realisation these days that you don't have to drink when you're in a pub. You don't have to drink alcohol when you're in a pub. You know, you can, and well done, great, love it. But, you know, they're community hubs. You know, these are places where all sorts of things go on, particularly in more and more remote places where often, you know, it might be one of few buildings in town. Or, you know, we read a story not so long ago, for example, about the Canargo Hotel. You know, there's not much going on in Canargo. There's a lot going on in Canargo, but there's not many buildings there apart from the CFS Hall and the pub. And I think there might be one house as you come in from the east. Anyway, yes, do on occasion, Terry, find myself in a pub. And usually not lost for something to do whilst there.
Definitely not. Well, enjoy all that, as I will enjoy my little foray as well. And I'm sure we'll have you back on the podcast in due course. I also thought it might be just a nice thing if there are readers of the, well, I certainly would hope there are readers of the magazine listening to the podcast, although some people may, you know, be more familiar with the podcast. Some people may be more familiar with the magazine. But we just, I guess, want to say thank you so much to our listeners and thank you so much to our readers, because without them, we cannot do any of this, can we?
Absolutely not. You know, we're doing it for a reason, and that reason is to share these stories. And you know, I thought you were going to run down another line there for a second, because I was reading the letters pages, the feedback pages, before this call, and I thought, gee, that's interesting. I wonder, you know, maybe we start to incorporate some of the readers into our podcasting, because some of the stories we get told, or some of the, you know, the letters we publish, they're worth a yarn in themselves.
Well, there's an invitation, listener. If you want to come on the podcast, let me know.
Excellent.
Always open to suggestions, that's for sure. People, places, subjects, all that good stuff, as we are at the magazine, of course, Mark.
That's right. So if people do have ideas, then, you know, sing out, write to us. publishing@rmwilliams.com.au, or you'll find our postal address in the magazine.
Or, of course, via the usual social media channels as well. Well, thank you very much for your time, Mark. I'm sure I need to let you go to let you get on with all those other things you do.
Thank you very much, Terry, and thank you for your time. I really enjoy listening to what you're doing on this podcast. I think it's great.
Thanks, Mark. Talk to you soon.
Cheerio.
And thank you for listening. We'll talk to you again soon.
Now's the time to upgrade to a new Ram truck. With unrivaled Hemi V8 power and a max brake towing capacity of up to 4.5 tonnes. With quick delivery available right now, you can get behind the wheel of a new Ram faster than ever. Stocks are limited, so see your Ram dealer or visit ramtrucks.com.au today. Ram eats everything else for breakfast. Stock and delivery times vary by model and dealer.